half hour of Mind Webs. Short stories from the worlds of speculative fiction.
This is Michael Hansen. Two stories on this edition of Mind Webs. The first is by Bill Pronzini, copyright 1970 by the author and the Ultimate Publishing Company. This is Dry Spell. The bane of all writers, John Kensington thought glumly, whether they be poor and struggling or whether they be rich and famous, is the protracted dry spell. He sat staring at the blank sheet of yellow foolscap in his typewriter. His mind was as blank as that paper. Not a single idea. Not a single line of writing that even remotely reached coherency in almost 3 weeks. Sighing, Kensington pushed back his chair and got on his feet. He went to the small refrigerator in the kitchenette, opened his last can of beer, and took it to the old Morris chair that reposed near his desk. I've got to come up with something, he thought. The rent's due in another week, and if I don't get something down on that grocery bill, I can forget about eating for a while. He sipped his beer, closing his eyes. Come on, son, he thought. Just an idea. Just one little idea. He let his mind wander. It seemed, however, to be wandering in circles. Nothing. Not even... wait a minute. Now wait just a single damned minute here. The germ of something touched a remote corner of his brain. It was a mere fragment, evanescent, but he seized it the way a man dying of thirst would seize a dipper of water. Grimly, he hung on. The fragment remained. Slowly, inexorably, it began to blossom. Kensington sat bolt upright in the chair, his eyes wide open now, the beer forgotten. His fingertips tingled with excitement. The coming of the idea was a catharsis, releasing the tension which had been building within him for the past 3 weeks. It would be a science fiction fantasy story, he thought. Probably a novella, if he worked it properly. He moistened his lips. Now, let's see. Suppose there's this race of aliens plotting to take over Earth because it's a strategic planet and some kind of intergalactic war they're involved in. Okay. So it's hackneyed. There are ways to get around that, ways to play that aspect down. These aliens have infiltrated Earth and set up some kind of base of operations, maybe up in the mountains somewhere. They're assembling a kind of penultimate cybernetic machine, which, when fully completed, will have the power to erase all rational thought from the minds of humans, turning them into obsequious zombies. Wait now. Suppose these aliens have a portion of this machine already completed. This portion would be capable of reading simultaneously the thoughts of every human on Earth, and of categorizing these thoughts for the aliens to study. That way, if any human somehow happened to blunder on the scheme in one way or another, mental blundering as well as physical would have to be considered, what with waves and the like, then the extraterrestrials would immediately know about it. And what they would do would be to train the full strength of this completed portion of the machine on that particular human, and with it, eradicate all those thoughts endangering their project, thus ensuring its safety. Kensington was sweating a bit now, his forehead crinkled in deep thought. Sure, he thought. Sure, it's a touch far out, but if I handle it right, who knows? At least it's a good, workable idea, which is a hell of a lot better than nothing at all. Now, how am I going to save Earth from this fate? It has to be in some way that's totally plausible, not too gimmicky, and all at once, the answer popped into his mind. By God, Kensington thought, it's perfect. There's not a flaw in it. He grinned hugely. Those damned aliens wouldn't stand the snowball's chance in you know where if I set it up this way. He stood abruptly and started for his typewriter. The progression of the story was already flowing, plotting itself firmly in Kensington's mind. He sat at the typewriter, excitement coursing through him because he knew he could feel that the dry spell was at an end. His fingers poised over the keys. Then quite suddenly, quite inexplicably, his mind went blank. He pressed his forehead against the cool surface of his typewriter. Why? He moaned silently. Why, oh, why can't I come up with just one little story idea? That was Dry Spell by Bill Bronzini. Copyright 1970 by the Ultimate Publishing Company. Thank you. MindWebs concludes this edition with a story from 1950. This is Jack Finney's The Third Level, copyright by the author. The presidents of the New York Central and the New York, New Haven, and Hartford railroads will swear on a stack of timetables that there are only two. But I say there are three, because I've been on the third level at Grand Central Station. Yes, I've taken the obvious step. I've talked to a psychiatrist friend of mine, among others. I told him about the third level at Grand Central Station, and he said it was a waking dream wish fulfillment. He said I was unhappy. That made my wife kind of mad, but he explained that he meant the modern world is full of insecurity and fear, war, worry, and all the rest of it, and that I just want to escape. Well, hell, who doesn't? Everybody I know wants to escape, but they don't wander down into any third level at Grand Central Station. But that's the reason, he said, and my friends all agreed. Everything points to it, they claimed. My stamp collecting, for example, that's a temporary refuge from reality. Well, maybe. But my grandfather didn't need any refuge from reality. Things were pretty nice and peaceful in his day, from all I hear. And he started my collection. It's a nice collection, too. Blocks of four of practically every U.S. issue, first day covers and so on. President Roosevelt collected stamps, too, you know. Anyway, here's what happened at Grand Central. One night last summer, I worked late at the office. I was in a hurry to get uptown to my apartment, so I decided to subway from Grand Central because it's faster than the bus. Now, I don't know why this should have happened to me. I'm just an ordinary guy named Charlie, 31 years old, and I was wearing a tan gabardine suit and straw hat with a fancy band. I passed a dozen men who looked just like me. And I was not trying to escape from anything. I just wanted to get home to Louisa, my wife. I turned into Grand Central from Vanderbilt Avenue and went down the steps to the first level, where you take trains like the 20th century. Then I walked down another flight to the second level, where the suburban trains leave from, ducked into an arched doorway, heading for the subway, and got lost. It's easy to do. I've been in and out of Grand Central hundreds of times, but I'm always bumping into new doorways and stairs and corridors. Once I got into a tunnel about a mile long and came out in the lobby of the Roosevelt Hotel. Another time, I came up in an office building on 46th Street. That's three blocks away. Sometimes I think Grand Central is growing like a tree, pushing out new corridors and staircases like roots. There's probably a long tunnel that nobody knows about, feeling its way under the city right now, on its way to Times Square. And maybe another to Central Park. And maybe because for so many people through the years Grand Central has been an exit, a way of escape, maybe that's how the tunnel I got into, but I never told my psychiatrist friend about that idea. The corridor I was in began angling left and slanting downward, and I thought that was wrong, but I kept on walking. All I could hear was the empty sound of my own footsteps, and I didn't pass a soul. Then I heard that sort of hollow roar ahead that means open space and people talking. The tunnel turned sharp left. I went down a short flight of stairs and came out on the third level at Grand Central Station. For a moment, I thought I was back on the second level. But then I saw the room was smaller. There were fewer ticket windows and train gates. And the information booth in the center was wood and old-looking. And the man in the booth wore a green eye shade and long black sleeve protectors. The lights were dim and sort of flickering. And then I saw why. They were open flame gas lights. There were brass spittoons on the floor. And across the station, a glint of light caught my eye. A man was pulling a gold watch from his vest pocket. He snapped open the cover and glanced at his watch and frowned. He wore a dirty hat, a black four-button suit with tiny lapels, and he had a big black handlebar mustache. Then I looked around and saw that everyone in the station was dressed like 1890-something. I never saw so many beards and sideburns and fancy mustaches in my life. A woman walked in through the train gate, and she wore a dress with leg of mutton sleeves and skirts to the top of her high-buttoned shoes. Back of her, out on the tracks, I caught a glimpse of a locomotive. A very small, Currier and Ives locomotive with a funnel-shaped stack. And then I knew. To make sure, I walked over to a newsboy and glanced at the stack of papers at his feet. It was The World, and The World hasn't been published for years. The lead story said something about President Cleveland. I've found that front page since in the public library files, and it was printed June 11th, 1894. Well, I turned toward the ticket windows, knowing that here, on the third level at Grand Central, I could buy tickets that would take Louisa and me anywhere in the United States we wanted to go. In the year 1894, and I wanted two tickets to Galesburg, Illinois. Have you ever been there? It's a wonderful town, still with big old frame houses, huge lawns, tremendous trees whose branches meet overhead and roof the streets. And in 1894, summer evenings were twice as long, and people sat out on their lawns, the men smoking cigars and talking quietly, the women waving palm leaf fans with the fireflies all around in a peaceful world. To be back there with the First World War still 20 years off and World War II over 40 years in the future, I wanted two tickets for that. The clerk figured the fare. He glanced at my fancy hatband, but he figured the fare, and I had enough for two coach tickets one way. But when I counted out the money and looked up, the clerk was staring at me. He nodded at the bills. "Now, that ain't money, mister," he said. "And if you're trying to skin me, you won't get very far." And he glanced at the cash register, the drawer beside him. Of course, the money was old-style bills, half again as big as the money we use nowadays, and different looking. I turned away and got out fast. There's nothing nice about jail, even in 1894. And that was that. I left the same way I came, I suppose. Next day, during lunch hour, I drew $300 out of the bank, nearly all we had, and bought old-style currency. That really worried my psychiatrist friend. You can buy old money at almost any coin dealer's, but you have to pay a premium. My $300 bought less than $200 in old-style bills, but I didn't care. Eggs were 13 cents a dozen in 1894. But I've never again found the corridor that leads to the third level at Grand Central Station, although I've tried often enough. Louisa was pretty worried when I told her all this and didn't want me to look for the third level anymore. And after a while, I stopped. I went back to my stamps, but now we're both looking every weekend, because now we have proof that the third level is still there. My friend, Sam Weiner, disappeared. Nobody knew where, but I sort of suspected because Sam's a city boy, and I used to tell him about Galesburg. I went to school there, and he always said he liked the sound of the place, and that's where he is, all right, in 1894. Because one night, fussing with my stamp collection, I found, well, do you know what a first day cover is? When a new stamp is issued, stamp collectors buy some and use them to mail envelopes to themselves on the very first day of sale, and the postmark proves the date. The envelope is called a first day cover. They're never opened. You just put blank paper in the envelope. That night, among my oldest first day covers, I found one that shouldn't have been there, but there it was. It was there because someone had mailed it to my grandfather at his home in Galesburg. That's what the address on the envelope said. And it had been there since July 18th, 1894. The postmark showed that. Yet I didn't remember it at all. The stamp was a 6-cent dull brown with a picture of President Garfield. Naturally, when the envelope came to Granddad in the mail, it went right into his collection and stayed there till I took it out and opened it. The paper inside was not blank. It read, 941 Willard Street, July 18th, 1894, Galesburg, Illinois. Charlie, I got to wishing that you were right. Then I got to believing you were right. And Charlie, it's true. I found the third level. I've been here 2 weeks, and right now down the street at the Dailies, someone is playing a piano, and they're all out on the front porch singing Nellie Home. And I'm invited over for lemonade. Come on back, Charlie and Louisa. Keep looking till you find the third level. It's worth it, believe me. The note is signed, Sam. At the stamp and coin store I go to, I found out that Sam bought $800 worth of old-style currency. That ought to set him up in a nice little hay, feed, and grain business. He always said that's what he really wished he could do, and he certainly can't go back to his old business, not in Galesburg, Illinois, in 1894. His old business? Why, Sam was my psychiatrist. That story is titled The Third Level, copyright 1970, by The Ultimate Publishing Company and the author Jack Finney. This is Michael Hansen speaking. Technical production for this episode of MindWebs by Darkman. This is a special production of MindWebs by WMSE 91.7 FM, Milwaukee.
That train from New York. Different trains.